Start speaking on the BTS diagnostic from the individual perspective. Robert Levitin, Professor, Department of Psychiatry, the Center for Addiction and Mental Health at the University of Toronto. Alain Daguerre, Associate Professor, Montreal Neurological Institute here at McGill. And Ahmed Elsami, Canadian Research Chair in Nutrigenomics, Associate Professor, Department of Nutritional Sciences, University of Toronto. And we'll begin with Robert.
Thank you very much to Laurette for inviting me today, and I'm very glad to hear the previous speakers because I can see how my biological talk ties in very nicely with some of the themes that have already been discussed this morning. So I'm going to talk about a particular aspect of individual vulnerability that relates to a particular type of gene that I think predisposes us to consume certain types of food. And I'll explain why in just a minute. And the idea here is not necessarily that our genes have changed recently in recent human history, but perhaps they do make us more vulnerable to particular environments that may not have existed a couple of hundred or a thousand years ago. And that's really, in many ways, the way we look at genetic effects these days, and predisposing us to particular environmental situations. Now, as a psychiatrist, I tend to deal with more extreme phenotypes, if you will, of overeating, or overeating in the context of psychiatric disorders. And in particular, my interest is in mood disorders. And many people, when they get depressed or have mood disorders, they overeat often as a way of compensating or trying to deal with negative emotional states. And if you look at the type of eating in these individuals, one way of understanding it is the concept of emotional eating, which has been alluded to in various ways today. And what emotional eating is really eating in response to emotions as opposed to eating in response to hunger, per se. And all kinds of different emotions trigger emotional eating. Sometimes it's depression, but also boredom. Anxiety and other negative mood states tend to promote emotional eating. Laurette's also published on positive emotional eating, which tends to be, I think, more in men and in certain cultures. In my practice, of course, I'm dealing more with the negative side of things. And this is also, I think, ties in nicely with the concept of comfort food that we hear about all the time in our day-to-day work. This is, I think, where the notion of comfort food really ties in nicely, the use of food to feel better, to feel comfort when you're in distress. And it also ties very much into addictions and the notion of using food as a drug to change your short-term mood state, which is really so much about what addictions are all about. And whenever you talk about addictions, of course, you are talking about certain parts of the brain, and in particular, brain reward systems, and the chemical dopamine, because dopamine is the neurotransmitter in the brain that is probably most important for reward and reward processes. This is just a cartoon of the brain's reward pathway. Do we have a pointer? Don't have a pointer. Okay. But what you can see here is just a very simplistic view of the brain reward pathway, which involves different key parts of the brain. One part, which you see there, called the limbic system, which tends to promote or at least mediate our more primitive emotions, like anger, sadness, etc. The amygdala is one example of a brain area that is quite relevant to anxiety. So we have the emotional aspect of addictions, if you will. We also have parts of the brain that control the experience of reward per se. And then we have the prefrontal and frontal cortices of the brain. Those are the more modern parts of the brain that control higher order functioning, things like planning ahead, decision making, is very much related to that part of the brain. And so we have an interesting pathway that really connects our more primitive emotional brain with brain reward areas and our more modern thinking brain, which is a rather interesting pathway for that reason. So addictions don't just involve reward, they also involve decision making in the frontal cortex and other parts of the brain that control emotions. And it's thought now, nowadays, I think we'll hear more about this from other speakers, but it's thought nowadays that this brain reward pathway is relevant to both natural rewards, but also to substance abuse of various types. And much of the research that's being done is to try to tease out the differences or similarities between natural and unnatural rewards. Now, the particular gene that I've been interested in that I'll talk about today is something called the dopamine 4 receptor gene. And I'm interested in this particular gene for a number of reasons, but one of which it's expressed in the brain's reward pathway. So the product of this gene will have influence on the brain's reward pathway. It's also highly variable, which means that different individuals are likely to have different variants. And that's good for genetic association studies. So you need variants, of course, in any kind of research when you're trying to find associations. The other important thing about this particular gene is that there is a variant of the gene which we know is very hypofunctional. If you inherit this part, this type of this variant, your dopamine function is likely to be much more sluggish than the next person who might have a different variant of the gene. And another aspect of the gene that's very interesting to me conceptually is the fact that one variant of this gene, the one that is hypofunctional, has actually been selected for in human evolution. So this is an example where our genes have changed a little bit, but not in the last 50 years, more over the last 40,000 or 50,000 years since humans evolved out of Africa. So that raises the issue of whether perhaps this hypofunctional dopamine allele could be a thrifty gene variant. Could it have done something in our history to make us survive related to food intake? And in many ways, some of the results that I will show you relate to this possibility in an interesting way. This is a cartoon of the dopamine 4 receptor, and it just gives you an idea of what that 7-repeat is all about. So if you look at the bottom, you see this big loop, and people who have the 7-repeat version of the gene will have that big loop. The more common variant involves a tighter loop, and that could explain the functionality at a molecular level. It could be the laxer, bigger loop leads to the hypofunctionality of the receptor. So this is an interesting cartoon that might actually demonstrate the functionality of the 7 versus the 4-repeat version of this gene. So the basic research question I've been interested in is whether this hypofunctional 7-repeat that's been selected for in evolution might be associated with weight gain, overeating, and mood in various depressed patients who tend to overeat, which is very much of what I see as a clinician. And this is data from one of the groups that I'm interested in, which are people who have seasonal depression. Seasonal depression is quite common in Canada. It's a form of depression that starts in the fall, right around the time that we change the clock, so in the next month or so, and continues to the spring, at which point people spontaneously improve. And I've always thought of this as a disorder of evolution, something that may have been helpful to us over thousands of years but becomes a nuisance in modern society. But the interesting thing as it relates to obesity is that most patients with this disorder will overeat, and they'll eat carbohydrates and fats and gain lots of weight. And what we found in our first study in this area is, in fact, that the 7-repeat gene variant that I described before is associated with a higher maximal lifetime BMI versus individuals who don't carry this allele. So we are quite excited about this. We did another study using the same data to show that the increase in BMI was due to binge eating behavior. So it wasn't due to lack of physical activity. Here we show with an even stronger effect size that the proportion of individuals with binge eating is much greater if they have this low dopamine variant. So it's not just affecting BMI, it's actually affecting binge eating behavior, which is quite interesting. We also looked at mood, in particular retrospective mood, and found that people with the 7-repeat allele, again, reported a greater degree of childhood dysphoria or low mood during their childhood, suggesting that their pattern of binge eating and weight gain may have related to their mood difficulties starting early in life, which gets us back to the notion of emotional eating, perhaps using food from an early age as a way to counteract negative mood states. Now, in genetic association studies, the biggest problem we always have is to replicate results, because there are many results that are not replicated. So we started to look at the same relationship in other overeating disorders. Bulimia nervosa is quite different than SAD in that there are episodes of binge eating, but with compensatory behavior. So purging, severe dieting as an attempt to limit weight gain. But even in these individuals, these are all women, by the way, even in these women who are greatly restraining their intake, we're still able to show a link between the 7-repeat variant and, again, maximum lifetime BMI versus the non-carriers of the gene. And you can see that the BMIs are a little bit lower, and that's because of the dietary restraint that characterizes this disorder. And now we're looking at the same gene in patients with binge eating disorder, which is, again, slightly different. Here one sees the binge eating to the extreme, but without the compensatory behavior. So you don't see the severe purging and severe dieting to the extent that you see it in bulimia. And so this is more of a pure eating disorder, if you will, in terms of overeating. And we're not finished the study yet, but so far the data look encouraging in the same direction, where that 7-repeat variant again seems to be predicting high BMIs in people who are already quite obese. So even the group without the gene has an average BMI around 35, but those with the gene variant are up around 42 in terms of their mean BMI. So this is now a third adult group, all females, all overeaters with lots of mood dysregulation, all of whom have high rates of emotional eating, and all of whom seem to have high BMIs as well. So this is the theoretical model that sort of ties this together. If you inherit the 7-repeat variant, presumably you have low brain dopamine activity, at least in particular parts of the brain, including the brain reward pathway. This may lead to a combination of negative moods, especially starting in childhood, and perhaps greater sensitivity to rewards, which is a combination, of course, that's going to lead to high intake of comfort foods, emotional eating, and what I call the atypical spectrum mood disorders, which include the disorders that I've described today. So seasonal depression, certain types of eating disorders, et cetera. Now, my interest in childhood obesity and childhood eating really comes from my clinical observation, and a well-known observation, that when you have people who describe the combination of depression and overeating, so often it begins early in life. So I've always been interested at some point to have the opportunity to go back and look at child developmental research, and I'm very lucky to be involved in work of this type. And this is sort of the strategy, to work backwards and forwards between adults and children to try to understand the problem. And the particular study that is the cornerstone of my work right now in terms of eating and mood is the so-called MAVAN study that you'll hear about a little bit more and over the next few years, hopefully, called Maternal Adversity, Vulnerability, and Neurodevelopment, the lead investigators being Michael Meany here at McGill and Steve Matthews at the University of Toronto. And MAVAN is basically a 5-year team grant sponsored by CIHR here in Canada to study how gene-environment interactions shape brain development and behavior. This is a multi-site, multidisciplinary study. You can see all the different areas of expertise in the different PIs. My particular interest is in the nutrition and affect regulation, the mood regulation aspect of the project. And this is basically a project where there are systematic longitudinal follow-ups of children with age-appropriate measures. There's also basic science animal research in parallel. And we're very much interested in intergenerational processes. So we want to see how these problems are transmitted from one generation to the next. And it's very much an integrative, collaborative approach. And this is just to finish off some preliminary data from MAVAN, which looks at that same gene variant that I've been describing. So this is the 7-repeat variant of the DRD4 gene. And what we have done is split the data based on gender. So you see boys who don't or do have the gene variant, girls who don't or do have the gene variant. These are our first 60 children. And lo and behold, when you look at total calories in the upper left, the group that stands out are girls who carry the 7-repeat variant that I've been discussing so far. So again, to Dr. Dubé's previous point, all the way back in time to age 4 might predict some of the vulnerability that leads to overeating in the patients that I see clinically many years later. And that's for total calories. If you look at the macronutrients, you can see a gender by gene interaction for fat intake. So the girls are taking in much more fat if they have the high-risk gene variant. Boys are going in the opposite direction. So boys who have the high-risk variant seem to be eating less fat. For carbohydrates, the story is a little bit different. Boys with the high-risk allele seem to be eating a lot of carbohydrates. So it could be the same gene effect is operating differently in the two genders. If you go back to the evolutionary model, I think it makes sense because fat intake in young girls predicts puberty and childbirth and is probably on an evolutionary basis quite important. One could argue that in boys, carbohydrate intake is more important because of long-term energy needs, etc. I would have expected proteins perhaps to follow that pattern and for boys to eat more protein for the same reason. The preliminary data suggests that boys with the 7-repeat are actually eating less protein than boys without. So the main effects really, though, relate to the risk allele and either fat intake in girls or carbohydrate intake in boys. So the model seems to be consistent across ages so far, although this is preliminary data and we have to be cautious. And just to finish up, acknowledging various collaborators for the project. Thank you very much.